go. But as we head through tomorrow night, a big change. Cloud and rain spreads into southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and Northern Ireland, and wet and windy weather spreads to all parts during Wednesday. Well, that's all for now. It's back to you, Alan.
Thank you, Ben. Well, now on Radio 4, it's time for our Book of the Week. Professor Dave Goulson has been fascinated with insects and animals all his life, and his particular interest is the bumblebee. In his new book, he explores the history and mysterious ways of these curious creatures and looks at how we can protect them for future generations. His first forays into bumblebee conservation at an early age, however, did not bode well. Tim McInerney reads episode 1 of A Sting in the Tail.
My interest in bumblebees and other insects dates back to the age of 7, when my family and I moved to a little village in Shropshire. The new house had a much bigger garden with flower borders, apple and damson trees, and a pond. My father allowed me to plant what I liked, so I put in lavender, buddleia, and catmint to attract bumblebees and butterflies. I planted a male pussy willow to provide the bees with early spring food. I built a large rockery out of old bricks, which I scavenged from a dilapidated farm building across the fields, carrying them home in a knapsack. I left spaces at the bottom for the bumblebees to nest in, and planted the top with bird's foot trefoil to provide flowers for them. I dug a bigger pond and stocked it with newts, sticklebacks, and all manner of other beasts from the local canal. I was an avid fan of Gerald Durrell's books, particularly those about his childhood growing up in Corfu, collecting all sorts of exciting animals and keeping them in his bedroom. He had owls, snakes and turtles. Hugely envious, I did my best to follow in his footsteps, making do with the more mundane fauna of Shropshire, starting with guinea pigs, rabbits, hamsters and mice. By the spring after we moved house, I noticed huge queen bumblebees, fresh from hibernation, feeding on the pussy willow and lungwort. I sat and watched them for hours. On one occasion, after a heavy summer rainstorm, I found a number of bedraggled bumblebees clinging to my buddleia and decided to dry them out. Unfortunately for the bees, I was perhaps a bit too young to have a good grasp of the practicalities. With hindsight, finding my mum's hairdryer and giving them a gentle blow-dry might have been the most sensible option. Instead, I laid the torpid bees on the hot plate of the electric cooker, covered them in a layer of tissue paper, and turned the hot plate onto low. I got bored with waiting for them to warm up and wandered off to feed my vicious little gerbils. Sadly, my attention did not return to the bees until I noticed the smoke. The tissue paper had caught on fire and the poor bees had been frazzled. I felt terrible. My first foray into bumblebee conservation was a catastrophic disaster. This did not bode well for the future, but at least I had learned that there is an upper temperature limit beyond which bumblebees are not happy. I was not fully aware of it at the time, but my childhood coincided with a catastrophic period in the history of the British countryside, at least from the point of view of a butterfly or bumblebee. At weekends, I would often walk with my friends to the Shropshire Union Canal, about 2 miles away across the countryside. When I started, this walk involved crossing 15 fields, each bounded by a hedge. By the time I left for university, the walk involved crossing one field, a huge one. Where once a bumblebee would have been able to find brambles in the hedges, cowslips in the hedge banks, and marsh woundwort on the sides of the canal, there was now only a sea of cereals. It's Adolf Hitler's fault. Not entirely, but he has to carry some of the blame. 100 years ago, fields tended to be small. Farmers depended on horses for power, and horses loved to eat clover, so most farmers grew clover. Bees also love clover. In the low-nutrient soils of hay meadows, wild flowers flourished. So imagine Britain 100 years ago, a patchwork of small fields, cereals and root crops intermixed with clover leys and permanent hay meadows. Lots of happy bees. Then roll forwards a few years. The internal combustion engine had by now provided farmers with an alternative to horses, in the form of tractors. The booming motor industry demanded oil, and the petrochemical industry that grew up on its back made it possible to synthesize cheap nitrogen-based fertilizers. These greatly boosted crop yields, so clover lays were abandoned. Horses were no longer needed, so no clover was necessary for feeding them. Before the war, Britain had been importing about 55 million tons of food each year. Suddenly, being able to supply enough food for our substantial population became terribly important. Patches of land which had previously been deemed too small to bother with were now ploughed and sown with crops. Hedges were ripped out, marshes were drained. Between 1939 and 1945, the area of land used for food production rose by 80%. Farmers continued to receive financial incentives to increase production until the 1990s. So, over a period of 50 years, we destroyed almost all the flower-rich habitats in the UK, and 98% of our lowland hay meadows disappeared. The short-haired bumblebee died out in Britain because the habitats in which it lived were destroyed. Luckily, Hitler didn't have the same effect in New Zealand, where the species survives, feeding on the red clover grown there as a lay crop. The bumblebee year begins with the emergence of the first brave queens from hibernation in spring. By this time, they are nearly starved. They drone slowly through the cold air, labouring to find scarce spring flowers. Pussy willows are one of the few plants in flower this early, and the female trees produce sugar-rich nectar, and it is this that the queens need first to boost their energy levels. The male trees produce bright yellow, pollen-bearing catkins, and this is where the queens go next to stock up on the protein-rich pollen. Their ovaries are shriveled and need protein to expand and develop their eggs. Over the next few weeks, the queens slowly fatten, and as their eggs begin to develop, they start to search for nest sites. Many species like to nest underground, but as bumblebees are pretty poor diggers, they often explore existing holes. This nest-searching behaviour is very characteristic, particularly in the buff-tailed bumblebee. These huge bees sway from side to side just above the ground, quartering across grassy terrain and along hedge banks in search of a mouse hole or other cavity. Very often they choose places where there is an old bird, rabbit, mouse or vole dwelling. They will enthusiastically rearrange the materials that they find around the nest into a nice cosy ball with a hollow centre. Often a wax dome is built over the nest, which helps to insulate it and keep predators out. Compared to the military precision of a honeybee nest, which contains regular flat sheets of perfectly hexagonal cells, the bumblebee nest is a rather ramshackle affair, but it serves well enough. The queen bee constructs a loose ball of insulating material with a central cavity and a hole through which she can squeeze. Within this, she makes a thimble-shaped cup from wax produced from special glands in her body, which is then moulded into shape with her legs and mandibles. She fills this cup with honey, honey being concentrated nectar. She forms pollen into a small ball about the size of a pea, using a drop of sticky honey to hold it together. This she also coats in wax. By now she is ready to lay eggs, which she fertilises as they pass out from her body, using the sperm stored inside her from her single mating the previous summer. Next, she excavates a small hole in her pollen ball, pushes a batch of eggs into the dough-like material, and then seals them over with wax. The mother incubates her eggs in the same way as a bird. She shapes the pollen ball to create a shallow groove along the top into which her body fits snugly. She has thin fur on her belly, so there is good contact between her and the brood. Now she begins to shiver to warm the eggs, keeping them at about 30 degrees centigrade, even when the air temperature outside the nest may dip well below freezing. Shivering uses lots of energy, which is why the queen has placed her pot of honey within easy reach, but this is not enough to keep her going. If she leaves her eggs for too long to collect more nectar, they will get cold. But if she does not go to fetch food, she will starve. A queen may use her own weight in sugar each day to incubate her brood, which necessitates visiting up to 6,000 flowers. A man running uses up the calories in a Mars bar in about 1 hour. A man-sized bumblebee, which would, I admit, be pretty terrifying, would exhaust the same calories in less than 30 seconds. Bumblebees have to eat almost continually to keep warm. A bumblebee with a full stomach is only ever about 40 minutes from starvation. If a bumblebee runs out of energy, she cannot fly, and if she cannot fly, she cannot get to flowers to get more food, so she is doomed. With a stomach full of sugar, she can start to fire up her flight muscles, shivering them to produce heat, and once she gets up to about 30 degrees centigrade, off she goes. After about 4 days incubation, the eggs hatch into tiny, comma-shaped white grubs, little more than eating machines. These unattractive creatures will shed their skins 3 times in about 2 weeks, by the end of which they will be roughly the size of a broad bean. At this point, the grubs each spin themselves a neat egg-shaped cocoon, using silk produced by glands in their mouths. Once inside their cocoon, they shed their skin again. Inside the pupal skin, an amazing transformation is taking place. The internal structures of the grub, the nerves, muscles, gut, and so on, simply dissolve, and the body rebuilds itself in the entirely different form of an adult bee. This reconstruction takes about 2 weeks, at which point the adult bee bursts out from the pupal skin and bites through the cocoon to escape. The first bees to emerge are all females, the queen's daughters and workers. When they first emerge, they are entirely white, resembling, with a little imagination, rather cuddly miniature polar bears. The wings are initially shriveled, but in the first few minutes after emerging, they pump blood into their veins to stretch them out. Once expanded, the wings quickly harden. As soon as their adult colours have developed, some of these workers venture outside to gather food. Food now begins to flow rapidly into the nest, and the queen starts to lay batches of eggs more regularly. By July, the nest may have grown to contain a sisterhood of several hundred worker bees, labouring together to help their mother. The queen now starts to lay both female and male eggs. Once they have emerged from the pupae, these new males and queens spend a few days resting, feeding on honey and pollen reserves. The males are doomed to be short-lived, for they have no way of surviving the winter. Their only role is to mate. In high summer, males sit around on flowers drinking nectar. They prefer flowers with big, sturdy heads, such as thistles and knapweeds, and gangs of males can often be seen clustered together like a group of men propping up the bar in a pub. Back in the old nest, the founding queen is now a little over a year old. She is frail and balding. As the aging workers die off, the food supply coming in dries up, and before long, all the bees are dead. By September, all that remains is a pungent and loose pile of empty pupal cells, honeypots, and bee corpses, which are slowly picked through and eaten by a range of scavengers such as woodlice, maggots, and beetles. The fat reserves in the new queen's body must keep her going during hibernation. Any queens that are smaller than average, or have slightly smaller stores of fat, tend to die. They're also prone to becoming mouldy in damp weather, or drowning in heavy winter rains, and it is likely that the vast majority of hibernating queens do not make it. Fortunately, some do, and as the first rays of spring sunshine warm the soil, they burrow upwards to the light, beginning the bumblebee year once again.
Episode 1 of A Sting in the Tail by Dave Gawson was read by Tim McInerney, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4, and you can hear the next part at the same time tomorrow. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now it's time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Tuesday the 7th of May. There are warnings of gales in Fitzroy. The general synopsis at 1800. Atlantic low moving rather quickly northeastwards, expected North Fitzroy 998 by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking. Variable becoming southeast 3 or 4. Occasional rain, fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. North Utsira, South Utsira. Southeasterly 3 or 4, occasionally 5 at first. Showers, good, occasionally poor. South 40s. Southerly backing southeasterly 3 or 4. Fair, moderate or good. North 40s, Cromarty. Variable 3 or 4, becoming southeasterly 4 or 5. Fog patches,